From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, life in America's inner cities. Journalist Alex Kotlowitz has written a new book about two boys growing up in one of Chicago's housing projects. We'll talk about the lure of crime, drugs, and gangs, and the difficulty of keeping out of the crossfire when gun battles are regular occurrences. The movie New Jack City is about a gang that turns an apartment building into a crack factory. We'll talk with Barry Michael Cooper, a journalist who co-wrote the screenplay and coined the expression New Jack City. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the comeback album from saxophonist James Clay, who was part of Ornette Coleman's band over three decades ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. French diplomats at the United Nations are lobbying other Security Council members to issue a formal condemnation of Iraq's treatment of its Kurdish and Shiite populations. Ordinary civilian members of both groups have reportedly suffered greatly as the Iraqi government moves to crush Kurdish and Shiite rebels. Kurdish leaders in Iraq have appealed to the UN to stop the government from massacring their people. The UN Charter doesn't authorize the organization to intervene in the internal affairs of any member state. So far, the official UN stand has been to stay out of the Kurdish question. Albanian opposition leaders charged today that heavily armed riot police attacked demonstrators in Tirana as they protested the communist election victory. Pierre Vickery reports that earlier clashes in the northern town of Shkodra left three dead and more than two dozen injured.
According to eyewitnesses, opposition supporters in Shkodra have taken over the Communist Party headquarters and distributed weapons. Parts of the building have been set alight, and several burnt-out military vehicles can be seen in the city center. Dozens of people were injured during the clashes, including a 14-year-old boy now in intensive care at the Shkodra hospital. In the capital, Tirana, riot police, firing live ammunition into the air and wielding batons, broke up a peaceful demonstration in front of the Democratic Party building. Opposition leader Salih Berisha has protested to the country's president, Ramiz Alia, and demanded that those responsible be brought to justice. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Today's mayoral election in Chicago may be distinguished by the lowest voter turnout in the city's history, NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Chicago election officials are predicting a 45% turnout in today's runoff. That's even lower than the 47% who re-elected Richard J. Daley near the end of his 21 years in the mayor's office. This election, the incumbent Democrat is Daley's son, Richard M. Daley, and he's widely expected to win his first full four-year term as mayor over challenges from Republican, Black Independent, and Socialist candidates. The younger Daley was elected mayor 2 years ago in a special election to fill the term of Harold Washington, who died in office. Daley won February's Democratic primary by a wide margin, and that victory is seen as one reason for the lack of voter interest in today's general election. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street, more than recouping the losses from yesterday. Analysts said the rise may have been touched off by higher bond prices and rising stock prices overseas. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 64 points to close at 2,945. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. There were more signs from Tehran today that there may soon be a release of Western hostages in Lebanon. Swiss Foreign Minister Rene Felber arrived in Tehran for meetings with Iran's president and foreign minister. Switzerland is the diplomatic intermediary between the United States and Iran. At the same time, the Iranians released a British businessman who's been held on spying charges for more than 5 years. That release is seen as a further sign that Iran wants to improve relations with the West. The 13 Western hostages in Lebanon are believed to be held by groups loyal to Iran. The Immigration and Naturalization Service opened seven offices across the country today to deal especially with immigrants seeking asylum in the United States. Mondelit Del Barco of member station WNYC reports.
The new asylum offices are designed to make it easier and more fair for immigrants wanting political asylum. INS spokesperson Duke Austin says the centers will be staffed by officers specially trained in human rights.
whether it be Central America or someplace in the Caribbean or Eastern Europe or the Middle East, we will have a corps of dedicated officers that can take their time to educate themselves on the internal conditions, to draw up all kinds of information based on those sending countries.
Austin says the program was created in response to complaints that decisions to grant asylum were politically biased and inconsistent. But some refugee advocates say the tremendous backlog of more than 100,000 cases seeking asylum may overwhelm the new officers, and that unless there are more trained officers around the country, the program will fail. For National Public Radio, I'm Mandalit Del Barco in New York.
The OPEC oil cartel reported today that the average price of its various types of crude oil was down again. Officials at the OPEC headquarters in Vienna said that the average price for a barrel of crude oil hit $16.77. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Those of us who are middle class know that living conditions are bad in America's inner city housing projects, but we may not realize how bad things have gotten. Alex Kotlowitz worries that many of us don't even care. In 1987, Kotlowitz wrote an award-winning series for the Wall Street Journal on the toll inner-city violence takes on the children who live there. He focuses on two of those children, Farrow and Lafayette Rivers, in the new book, There Are No Children Here. Farrow and Lafayette live in Chicago's Henry Horner housing project. It's only about a mile from Kotlowitz's downtown office, but it's a world away. In the summer of 1987, police estimated that an average of one person every 3 days was beaten, shot, or stabbed in the 8 blocks of these high-rise projects. There is no security. The hallways are dark, even in the daytime. Kotlowitz says that even though he knew conditions would be bad in the projects, he was still shocked by what he saw.
I was very surprised. In fact, when I first met Lafayette, the older of the two boys that I write about, when I first met him, he told me about two incidents, one in which he watched a young boy die on the stairwell outside his apartment, and also about a 10-year-old girl who had been shot in the leg while jumping rope out in front of his building. And he told it in such a matter-of-fact way that I didn't quite believe it when he first told me about it. I didn't quite believe all this violence actually occurred. And it took me a while, going back time and time again, to realize that, in fact, these kids, if anything, were sort of understating what actually was taking place. I think conditions have gotten just so much worse in the past 15, 20 years in our inner cities.
Well, the mother in the family that you wrote about was so concerned she took out burial insurance on her children.
Right, which apparently is not unusual. There's such a concern that these children aren't going to make it to adulthood. Lafayette, for example, talks about when you ask him what he wants to be when he grows up, he doesn't say when I grow up, he says if I grow up. And there's a real sense of mortality in this community, a real sense that the death may just be right around the corner.
Why did you focus on the specific family that you did? Was there something about them that you felt summed up a way of life, or were they a particularly good family to use as a guide to let you know what was happening in the projects?
Well, I think particularly what attracted me to the family were the two boys, Farrow and Lafayette, because when I first started writing the book, Farrow was 9 and Lafayette were 12, and what struck me about them is here were two children from the same family who dealt with the traumas and the violence and the tragedies in their lives in very different ways. Lafayette, who keeps everything to himself and is a very sad, if not depressed, boy. And Farrow, who's very spirited and loves school and clutches onto his childhood with incredible vigor. And so what attracted me to the family was, in fact, was the sort of dichotomy between these two children, which I thought was fairly representative of how kids in neighborhoods like these try to get by.
Well, also they had older brothers and sisters who had already run into pretty serious problems.
Right, and that was the other thing about the family that interested me and attracted me to using them, profiling them for a book like this was, yeah. In fact, one of the boys during the course of the book is sent to prison for armed robbery, and not uncommon for young black men to end up in prison. And the other thing is there's a long history of drugs in the family. The older sister who has been battling a drug habit for a number of years now, and also the father, who for almost 2 decades, off and on, has been battling drugs and primarily heroin and liquor. And that interested me. And the mother also, there's a certain attraction about the mother because she, on the one hand, is a very strong woman. She has absolutely nothing to do with drugs or drink and really cares so much about her children and has invested so much of herself in her kids and sees, in a sense, her way out of that life is for her kids to make it. And yet she's been so disappointed along the way, as so many mothers has. And there's a part of her that I can see beginning to give up. There's a certain passivity about her beneath all that strength, a certain sense of fatality about bringing up children in a neighborhood like this. And of course, she was the one who came up with the title of the book. When I asked her whether she thought it a good idea for me to write a book about her children and their friends, she said, Alex, that sounds like a wonderful idea, but you know, there are no children here. They've seen too much to be children.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Alex Kotlowitz, and his new book is called There Are No Children Here. And it's focusing on children that he spent a lot of time with, and as a matter of fact, still does spend a lot of time with, who live in the Henry Horner housing projects in Chicago. Let's get back to the two kids who you really focus on in your book, Lafayette and Pharaoh. Are there ways in which children of their age, which they in particular, are preyed on by the drug lords, by the gangs in the neighborhood?
You know, one of the things that I found curious when I went out there, and sort of one of the number of myths that for me was in a sense popped, was the idea that these young children, 10, 11, 12 years old, are wrapped up in the gangs and wrapped up in drugs. And in fact, what I found were children very much trying to be children. And in that, and having watched all that had gone on with their older brothers and sisters and older friends, that they talk about drugs disparagingly. They can't at that age imagine touching drugs or being involved with the gangs. And in fact, there's a gang leader in my book who doesn't want children, young children, running drugs for him. But once they turn 14, 15, 16 years old, the currents become so strong that these kids just find it so hard to swim against it.
What kind of currents are you talking about? Specifically?
The gangs, for one. The drug gangs out there is certainly the primary source of employment for a lot of these children, and for some of them, the primary source of family. And a lot of these children will become very wrapped up in the gangs, which now in Chicago and other cities, a primary reason for being is to sell drugs. And so often the kids will get wrapped up in the gangs. There are kids who, when they turn 15, 16, 17 years old, will also begin to take drugs themselves or begin to drink and also begin to commit crimes. One of the things that struck me is it's just an incredible amount of anger in these children. And you can see how it begins to find its way to the surface as they get older.
While you were working on this book, Lafayette, the older brother, started getting involved with a little bit of shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to see a sense of change in him as he started doing that?
Yeah, you know, I did. Lafayette, who is, as I mentioned earlier, somebody, a boy who keeps so much to himself and has so much trouble just opening up. In fact, during the course of the book and having gone to two funerals, I never saw him cry once. And I did begin to see changes in him. He got involved in a shoplifting incident, and later on in the book, too, he also got involved in allegedly breaking into a car by the stadium. And one of the things that he said to me I thought was very telling. After I had finished the book, he said to me, Alex, I'm worried that I'm going to end up like my older brothers and sisters. And there was a sense that his destiny and fate was out of his hands, that he just simply did not have much control over what was going to happen to him. And there is that sense of hopelessness, particularly as the kids get older.
You became so close to the kids you were writing about. Did you try to change their behavior in any way, or direct them in any way?
Yeah, it was when I started off writing the book, I think I went in there with a sense that I could sort of keep some distance and write about these children and sort of stay in the background. And I guess ultimately I found that impossible and became very good friends with both the boys. And there were times that we would sit down and just talk, and particularly after that shoplifting incident, for example, and Lafayette and I had a long talk about what that meant. I mean, it's a community that sort of doesn't allow for adolescent mistakes, and I don't know. I'm sure that my effect on the kids was in a sense twofold, one good and one and perhaps one not so good. On the one hand, I'm sure I offered some positive influence, somebody they could talk to certainly about all that was going on. On the other hand, because we spent a lot of time outside the community and saw other places, we go on a annual fishing trip, that I'm sure there's some bitterness amongst them that they haven't expressed to me, because now they have a strong sense about what could be, about how things could be different.
You've talked about how often children get caught in the crossfire, in gunfights in the housing projects. Did you ever witness any of the gunfights that you described?
There were times that I was caught down in the crossfire when I had to take cover on the floor. There were often times when you would hear the gunshots. I can remember one time being out on the playground with the kids, and there were sounds of gunfire, and the kids who were so quick to react ran into that building and left me on the playground by myself, and I just had to take off after them. It's part of the daily life in neighborhoods like this.
Alex, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is journalist Alex Kotlowitz, and he's written a new book called There Are No Children Here. And it's about years of research that he did in a housing project in Chicago. And the book focuses on two boys growing up in that project. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Alex Kotlowitz is my guest, and his new book, There Are No Children Here, grew out of a series of articles he wrote for the Wall Street Journal. You spent a lot of time talking to Pharaoh and Lafayette's mother. What are some of the things that she feels she's up against trying to bring children up in the kind of environment that they live?
Well, as I said earlier, there is a sense that things are out of her hands, that in some ways there's a sense that whatever she does, however hard she tries, there are still things beyond her control. And in fact, she's absolutely right. I mean, there's only so much you can do, you can only be so vigilant about watching after your children. And she worries one, I mean, her biggest worry is that her children will get caught in crossfire, as so often happens at Henry Horner. I mean, she worries about her children dying. As you point out earlier, here she is taking out burial insurance on her children who have not even reached adolescence.
One of her sons, Terrence, was a father by the time he was 14. By 18, he'd been arrested 46 times. Does she blame herself for that, or does she just blame the conditions in the project and in the neighborhood?
I think that for her, you know, she would alternate. There would be times that she would blame the neighborhood and blame how the conditions, how worse things had gotten, how much harder it was to grow up there. And at other times, she would be more reflective and think that if only she had done things differently. One of the things that struck me in being out in that community for all these years is that being in such an oppressive environment, that the human frailties quickly rise to the surface. And I think with somebody like LaJoe, she sensed that too with herself, that there were things about her that would sort of become much stronger character traits than they otherwise might have. And I think she worried that at times she wasn't strong enough with her, forceful enough with her children, that she was too passive, that she worried early on that maybe she had paid too much attention to Terrence, that she had spoiled him in a sense. At one point, she even confided that she had promised him that she wasn't going to have any more children. And of course, she proceeded to have five more kids. So yeah, there is a lot of self-blame, and you begin to lose some sense of self-respect for yourself. I mean, I think it's the ultimate tragedy in communities like this that the adults who do care and who do feel a sense of strength and begin to lose their children begin to lose some sense of self-respect because they take some of the responsibility for what happened.
Where did the Rivers family get their income, and how much money a month would they live on?
The mother is on public aid, and she has been for about 8 years. And she receives I think roughly $540, $550 in cash each month. And in addition to that, she receives about $300 or $400 in food stamps. And this is for her and her five children, Lafayette and Pharaoh, and then there are a set of triplets who are now 8 years old. In addition to that, she has other people living in her apartment. She also has her older daughter and her older daughter's boyfriend, and they have three children. And Lajel's brother often spends time over there. Now, her daughter also receives some public aid, so that money doesn't have to feed all of them. But as is typical in most families that receive public aid, by the end of the month, by the third or fourth week, she begins to run out of food stamps and runs out of food. And the children really have to cut back on their meals, and there are occasions when they are at times hungry.
You had written a story about this family previously for the Wall Street Journal, and you suspect that as a result of the story, the Rivers family ended up with less money in their federal benefits.
Right. I don't suspect. I know. In fact, after my story came out, the Public Aid Department launched a large investigation about Lajoe's eligibility for public aid. And the reason for that, there was one line in my story in which I mentioned that her husband, Paul, who at the time was a bus driver for the city, sporadically lived at home. And in fact, he sporadically came home. Most of his money, however, went to drugs and alcohol. And Public Aid had seen that one line, the Department of Public Aid had seen the one line in my article, and subsequently launched this massive, humiliating investigation of Lajoe and indeed cut her off from public aid. The Public Aid Department conceded to me that, in fact, they spend a lot of their time looking through newspapers to find possible so-called cheats, people who might be ineligible on welfare. I think for me that was so symbolic of what this nation has gone through over the past 10 or 15 years, where here an agency, the Department of Public Aid, which provides money for mothers and their children, rather than trying to assist these families, is actually spending time going out and trying to figure out ways to cut off benefits. And it is a mindset that I think this nation has got to get out of, in which we really begin to need to look and how we can assist families like the Rivers, and not ways to make life more difficult for them.
You didn't maintain the typical journalist's distance from your subjects. You used the money from an award that you got to bail out one of the brothers in the family that you're writing about. You've used money that you've gotten from your book to send the two boys who you focus on to private school.
Mm-hmm.
What went behind your thinking when you decided to use your own money to directly improve their lives?
I think ultimately spending all that time with Lafayette and Pharaoh, it was hard, first of all, not to become very close to them. And it was a friendship, I think, that probably has, at least I know, has enriched my life a lot. And spending so much time with them, I felt an obligation as a friend to do what I could to help them. And indeed, I did send the two boys to private school. Lafayette is now back in public school. It was too tough for him academically. And I did that after I finished reporting the book, not because I sort of held back the money, but frankly, I didn't have the money until I completed the book. But I think without meaning to sound falsely modest, I can't imagine that anybody might have embarked on an endeavor like this and not have become very close with these children. I mean, I constantly had to remind myself through the course of this book that these are just children. They're just kids. And I was very sensitive to that. There were often times when I would ask them, I was very careful to tell them everything that was going into the book. And there were some small things that they asked me not to put in the book, mostly things that might embarrass them, kids' things. And I was very sensitive to that. And it was also my reason ultimately for focusing on the children, is because whatever you can say about the adults, the children are innocent. They're innocent of what is and of what could be. You're absolutely right. We did become very good friends over the course of the book, and there may be those who say I wasn't objective, but it's hard to watch children growing up in an environment like that and not not to pull it and tug at your heart.
What are Pharaoh and Lafayette doing now?
Pharaoh's in his he's in seventh grade at Providence St. Mel, an all-black private school on the west side. And it's been hasn't been without a struggle for him, but he's one determined kid. And he wants to go on to college, and I think that if he keeps at it, that it's not unlikely for him. Lafayette is back in public school. Lafayette's not as academically inclined as Farrell, and he's managed to stay away from the gangs, and he's managed to stay out of trouble with the law. But as I mentioned earlier, he did, just a few months ago, said to me he worries that he's going to be like his older brothers and sisters and like his older friends, and there is a sense that things are a little bit out of his control. And he's also a boy who cares so much about everybody else that sometimes he doesn't spend enough time worrying about himself.
So you've done things to directly help the two boys you've written about. Have you had to confront the difficult situation of drawing the line when asked for something?
I pause because it has been an issue, and the issue of where to set limits. I think for my friendship with Lafayette and Farrell, there probably are no limits in what I'm willing to do, given my capabilities. I think with other family members and other people out there have been limits set, and it's been very difficult setting those limits. Because people know and that first of all, that if people need loans, for example, often people will come to me and ask if they can borrow money. And I understand that they have no other source of borrowing, nobody else to borrow money from other than the drug dealers, and it has been very tough setting the limits. But I think with Farrow and Lafayette, with the two boys, that we have a very close friendship, and I think that the limits in our friendship are the limits of any friendship, which I think are infinite.
So what do you tell the people who you have to say no to?
It's hard, Terry. It's hard, and often I find I can't say no. So it's
well. Do they play on your like whiteness and middle classness?
I think that in fact I think the people who might ask me are people I've become friends with over the years,
mm-hmm.
And I think they ask me as a friend. And there have been people who have finally just said no to. There have been people who I've known there for many years who might have asked to borrow $50 or $75 and I know will pay me back. And there are people who may ask to borrow that money and I know won't pay me back. And so that plays into it. I mean, there is a sense from my part that, you know, that as much as we as a nation, I don't mean to sort of disengage myself from this, but that we've neglected these neighborhoods, but also that people in these neighborhoods have neglected themselves. And ultimately, my feeling was that if people respected me, I would respect them. And if people wanted to borrow $50 and paid me back, then I would be willing to lend them money again. And if they didn't, I just said no.
Well, Alex, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Alex Kotlowitz, and he's the author of the new book, There Are No Children Here, The Story of Two Boys Growing Up in the Other America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is the sound. Have your partner and get down. Everyone must know. Been here before. Now we're gonna give you more. It's time to let it show. Music is funky. Girls are so fine.
Yo, fellas, y'all better push up.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A few years ago, the term New Jack was a street put-down. Journalist Barry Michael Cooper took that term and applied it to the new young urban drug lords. Coming up, Barry Michael Cooper tells us how he drew on his urban reporting to co-write the screenplay for New Jack City. In the 1950s, saxophonist James Clay was part of Ornette Coleman's band, but Clay left the group right before Coleman hit it big. Now Clay has a new solo album. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The State Department says the U.S. will hold high-level meetings with Iraqi dissidents in Washington tomorrow. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler says Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly will meet with six Iraqi Muslim intellectuals who represent Sunni and Shiite sects, along with members of other opposition groups. Two American citizens will also attend. The Bush administration says that Iraqi troops are in control of most of the country, but all but ending the rebellion against Saddam Hussein. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Pentagon says forces loyal to Saddam Hussein control all major cities in Iraq, including Kirkuk. That's despite claims by the Kurds that they've retaken the northern city. Pentagon spokesman Bob Hall says after a weekend of heavy fighting, the Kurds are in retreat.
The Kurdish forces have largely withdrawn into the mountains in face of superior firepower. This is consistent with past Kurdish tactics when facing overwhelming force.
Hall says some fighting continues in rural areas. The State Department says Iraq is in the process of what it calls leveling the Kurdish city of Tuz Kermatu and continues to send reinforcements into northern areas of the country. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
France says it's demanding that the UN Security Council act to end the massacre of Kurdish and Shiite civilians being carried out by Saddam. French Foreign Minister Daniel Bernard said France will take up the issue with UN Chief Javier Pérez de Cuellar. Reports from Iraq indicate that government troops have killed thousands of Kurds fleeing the fighting. The attack on the rebels in the north follows the crushing of a Shiite uprising in the south. German government officials say the gun used to kill a leading German industrialist last night was also used in a February shooting attack on the U.S. Embassy in Bonn. No one was injured in the embassy attack. Deidre Berger has more.
Federal prosecutor Alexander von Stahl says he is fairly certain last night's attack on Detlef Rohweder was carried out by the left-wing Red Army faction. A letter from the terror organization was found in a garden near Rohweder's Dusseldorf home. Criminal officials suspect the assailant or assailants shot from the garden, hitting Rohweder in the back as he stood near the window of his second-floor study. The 58-year-old Rohweder was head of the Treuhandanstalt, or Trust Corporation, a bond-backed agency in charge of privatizing East Germany's state-owned industry. Rohweder and his agency have come under growing criticism for company closures, which has contributed to soaring unemployment in the eastern part of Germany. Union officials say they will stop weekly rallies against unemployment in eastern Germany in hopes of preventing further violence in the charged atmosphere. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Bergen.
On Wall Street, stocks closed sharply higher today. The Dow rose 64 points to close at 2945.05. This is NPR News. Cuban President Fidel Castro says his country will stick with socialism, even with its economic problems and the fall-off in aid from the troubled Soviet Union. The official Cuban news agency quoted Castro, who's criticized sweeping democratic and liberal changes in Eastern Europe in the past. Cuba has been greatly dependent on about $5 billion in aid and subsidies from Moscow, but the money is dwindling. According to a just-released congressional report, payments to doctors under the Medicaid payment plan are so low that many doctors refuse to treat poor Medicaid patients. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
In New York, doctors get reimbursed $11 for a routine visit when they treat a Medicaid patient. In West Virginia, they get $10. In Louisiana, 14. By contrast, commercial insurance pays about $35 for an office visit, and Medicare, the government program for the elderly and disabled, pays about $25. As a result, more and more doctors, says this report, refuse to see Medicaid patients. In fact, 44 states report that Medicaid patients have trouble finding routine and even emergency medical care. This report is the most comprehensive look so far at the Medicaid program. It recommends increasing some payments, cutting back on administrative costs, and subsidizing the cost of malpractice insurance for doctors who treat Medicaid patients. This is Patricia Named reporting.
NASA has begun the countdown for the first space shuttle flight of the year. The Atlantis space shuttle will carry a huge observatory into orbit, and two crew members will take the first spacewalk in 5 years. Atlantis is scheduled to blast off at 9:18 a.m. Eastern Time on Friday. The Gamma Ray Observatory will be released on the third day of the 5-day mission. It will survey the entire sky during its scheduled mission of 2 years. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The movie New Jack City is an action film about the new black gangsters who rule the inner city. A gang of crack dealers terrorizes the residents of a ghetto apartment building, takes over the building, and turns it into a drug factory. My guest, Barry Michael Cooper, co-wrote the screenplay. He drew on his own reporting. Cooper is a journalist who's written about black urban youth culture for The Village Voice and Spin. Here's a clip from New Jack City. The director, Mario Van Peebles, plays a cop who recruits a renegade undercover cop to bust the crack operation. The undercover cop is played by rap star Ice-T.
So what y'all come here for, man? To watch me exercise?
I came here to lay a name on you. Nino Brown, sidekick Gerald G. Money Wells.
Yeah, they call themselves the Cash Money Brothers.
You should stick up check cashing joints, two-bit jewelry stores.
Yeah, some brothers from Esplanade Gardens, thrill seekers, wannabe gangsters. I hate them, so what's up?
All right, what's up is this. We need some evidence, man. Evidence of murder, drug trafficking, racketeering, tax evasion, man, anything. The department has never been able to make anything stick on Brown.
One-third of the department is probably on Nino's payroll. The other two-thirds don't care unless it affects their community.
So what you saying?
Hey, listen. I've been authorized to set up an independent drug-fighting unit, and I'm picking you. Got it?
Why me?
New Jack City is an indictment of crack dealers, but were you surprised, nevertheless, when it was considered so controversial when it came out?
No, not at all, because, first of all, we've never seen those images on screen before told in that manner from the perspective of an African-American, which is what I am, as opposed to having it come from some young white kid, film student from the Midwest or even from UCLA or USC. I mean, the original script, some of the original drafts of the script were even more intense. They were more claustrophobic. They were more along the lines of, a Goodfellas, you know, a Harlem version of Goodfellas. And now what you see on screen, not that I have anything against it at all, because it's... The bottom line, it's making money and people are getting the message that, you know, drugs are bad and stuff like that. But my version of the film was a lot more dark and claustrophobic.
You coined the term New Jack, New Jack City, New Jack Swing. What did it mean to you and how did you come up with it?
Well, the term New Jack City and New Jack Swing came about around 1985, 1986, when my younger brother, who was about to go into service, and who was, like myself, tied into the street, used to hear these rap records, and they would talk about a guy as a New Jack clown or this guy's a New Jack that, and I would say, you know, Brent, that's my brother's name. I said, Brent, you know, what does that New Jack mean? And he says, it's like a rookie, you know, somebody wet behind the ears, a sucker, you know, he's green, you know, he's not up to snuff. And so originally the term was in the pejorative, you know, it was a negative term, and rap records circa 1986 to 1989, the word New Jack is a slur. It's an insult. But what I think I did was try to reverse the lexicon, so to speak. And when I did a story in Detroit for Voice called New Jack City Eats Its Young, Motor City Breakdown. And it was about the rise of these young, powerful drug gangs who were making like $500 million a year, you know? And these were guys who would just walk up on you and kill you in broad daylight. They didn't wait for the cover of darkness. You know, they thought that if they did it in broad daylight and in a crowd of people, they would be more respected and feared and, you know, the whole nine yards. And these guys, you know, made, I don't know, the younger, the runners, I mean, the peons of each of the structure, you know, the dope, the drug infrastructure, were making like $1,000, $2,000 a day. So, I mean, to me, that was a new jack. These were the new, you know, the new examples of the privileged underclass, so to speak. The ones who carried beepers and cellular phones and drove Jeeps and, you know, went out to the malls in Michigan and bought and spent $10,000 at a drop at Gucci's or Fendi's and places like that. You know, I've never seen that before. You know, it was a totally new lifestyle to me.
Is the movie based on a story that you wrote?
Well, it's an amalgam of different stories, so to speak. Initially, I adapted the script from a great screenwriter, Thomas Lee Wright, and he wrote a screenplay on the drug czar, Harlem drug czar from the 1970s, Leroy Nicky Barnes. But when I got the script, I told the producers, George Jackson and Doug McHenry, I said, look, this is a little dated. You know, I mean, we could do a period piece, but I think it would be more exciting and more explosive to do something to update it into the crack era, you know, with guys like Fat Cat Nichols and the guy from D.C., I can't think of his name right now, Rafael Edmonds and people of that nature. And then people I had known growing up. You know, I mean, I played basketball with, I myself, and if I may be honest here, about 11 years ago, I had a drug problem. You know, I was using angel dust and cocaine. I mean, thank God I've kicked, and I haven't, you know, been an abuser in about 11 years. But I know these people, you know, I'm aware of them. I didn't sell drugs, but I was a drug purchaser. You know, so, I mean, I knew this story inside and out. And so, you know, that's why it comes across as so authentic, because it is.
The gangster has become one of the, you know, most important images in rap songs now, in rap music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does gangster mean in rap lingo? I mean, is it something different from the literal meaning of gangster?
No, it means the same thing. It might just take on a... It probably takes on a different level of meaning in the hip-hop world. I mean, the gangster has his own mythos of someone who is to be respected and feared. He is secretly admired because he's financially, you know, secure. It means the same thing as it does in the larger society, but it just takes on a different level of meaning because his mythos is tied to a sense of achievement and getting over and going against the system and winning, even if his lifespan is really, you know, short. At least he got over for a certain period of time. Now, I'm not placing any judgment on this. As a matter of fact, I think that's a little twisted myself.
My guest is journalist Barry Michael Cooper. He co-wrote the screenplay for the film New Jack City. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist and screenwriter Barry Michael Cooper is my guest. You grew up in Harlem.
Yes.
Apartment house, housing project, tenements?
Well, initially, I grew up in the tenements. And then my family, we moved to a middle class co-op called Esplanade Gardens, which was which produced a lot of gangsters themselves. But these gangsters weren't gangsters because of economic factors. There was an emotional factor to that. They had to prove that they were tougher than the guys in the tenements around them and in the, you know, in the you know, the socially depressed areas. So they went out and they tried to sell more drugs or kill more people or whatever to, you know, become a lot tougher. But they were very conflicted in their choices because they were expected to go to Harvard or to Yale or to Brown or, you know, and a lot of these guys went to Catholic school and they went on to maybe Fordham Prep or Power Memorial. I mean, really good schools in New York. And then they took the other route to really hold their head high among the gangsters in the street, you know.
The neighborhood that you grew up in, has it changed?
Yeah, it's gotten worse.
What's it like now?
Just a lot more drugs. I've seen entire strips of streets, you know, just building after building abandoned with only a building left in it. And that one building is a crack house, you know. Yeah, it's changed a whole lot. But I can't blame this totally on the guys who are selling drugs. There's a whole thing that goes along with that, you know. The Reagan era created crack, because when the after school centers were cut, when the community centers were cut, when the summer programs were cut, people had nowhere to turn. We were imploding. You know what I'm saying? And it's not just, people want to look at the movie New Jack City and just the inner city and 48 Hours and Primetime Live and all of those shows and say, look at those niggas. They ain't got nothing else to do. They got too much time on their hands. They're all on welfare. Well, it's not like that. That's not true. You know, that's a very warped picture of the inner city. The inner city was helped along in its, you know, total devastation by, you know, the government.
New Jack City is in part about how an apartment building gets turned into a crack house. Have you seen that happen? I mean, do you have anything you can tell us about how a place gets turned into a crack house?
Well, I mean, it's pretty close to the movie. I mean, not that it was a little overboard dramatized. People don't just bust in your house. But after a while, you see people on the staircase, you see people dealing, you know, you hear shots at night. I mean, all night long. And I'm not talking about a .38 special. I'm talking about Glocks, which are 9mm, you know, the ones that can support the lightweight 9mm, AK-47s. You know, it sounds like you're in Beirut. And after a while, and if you're bringing up young kids, you don't want to live in that environment, so you move out. You don't want to be there anymore. You know, and that's the whole game plan of the dealers, whether they're very conscious of it or subconscious of it. Their activity drives people out. You don't want to live in that environment.
And then they take over. You've written a lot of stories about this kind of culture in the past few years. I wonder, do you have, like, you know, drug dealers who are your sources who you can talk to? You know, as you said, New Jack City is about the gangsters. It's not about the victims. So do you have people who you can talk to get a sense of what the life is like
now? Well,
it's
not that. I live around that. You know, I mean, these people are, they're my friends, you know? I mean, I don't do what they do. They don't do what I do, but they respect me. And on a certain level, I respect them, but I don't respect what they do. You know, it's not that they're, you know, my sources are, you know, come here in this little dark corner and tell me what's going on. I'm around them. You know, we might talk about life. These people are not just, I'm not defending what they do. What they do is a very heinous crime. But I'm not God here to judge anybody. I mean, they got to deal with that when it's time for them to deal with that. But we talk, and we talk not only about the street, we talk about their aspirations. Well, Barry, if I can't live like this anymore. And I know I'm going to either wind up in jail or dead. And if I'm in jail, I may die there too. But what am I to do? I'm trapped. I can't show that I'm a punk, man, because if I go out soft, I'm going to get taken out. Somebody's going to, you know, put two in the head. So I'm trapped, man. I have nowhere else to go. And it's something on that level.
Now, you're talking about a culture in which, you know, wearing a lot of gold is a sign of your achievement and everything. Do you feel that you have to invest some of your money in that just to kind of have a sense of status in the neighborhood?
No.
Or to show that you've made it on your own terms?
No. And people are not wearing that gold anymore. I mean, that level is gone. I mean, New Jack was, the production was almost like, I wrote the script 2 years ago. We went into production last year. They're not really wearing that anymore. They don't wear anything. I mean, the whole lifestyle now, And it's just like the larger society. I mean, this society ingests what the larger society does and then inverts it. So where everybody is going to the Gap to dress now, these guys are going to the Army and Navy store. They're not wearing gold chains. They're wearing dungarees, Timberlands, you know, dungaree suits, baseball caps. I mean, they're totally, you wouldn't know them. If you saw him on the street, you might think he's a messenger, you know, down on Wall Street or whatever. And he has, you know, maybe like $5, $6 million in the bank.
Any guesses why there's been that change?
One, to get some of the heat of the cops off of them, and just two, to walk around freely. I mean, that has become a drug insignia now, those big gold chains. So, I mean, just to get away from, I really can't answer that. I don't know. That's just a guess.
Barry Michael Cooper co-wrote the screenplay for the new film, New Jack City.
Hustler. Word, I pull the trigger long, grit my teeth, spray to every nigga's gone. Got my block sewn on my dope spots. Last thing I sweat, so suck a punk cop. Move like a king when I roll hop. You try to flex, bang, another bang. Nigga drops. You gotta deal with this, cause in the way out. Why? Cash money ain't never gonna play out. I got nothing to lose, much to gain. In my brain, I got a capitalist migraine. I gotta get paid tonight. You motherfucker, all right, thinking my grip. Check my bitch, keep my game tight. So many hoes on my jock, think I'm a movie star. 19, I got a $50,000 car. Go to school, I ain't going for it. Kiss my ass, bust the cap on the Moet. Cause I don't wanna hear that crap. Why? I'd rather be a new jack hustler.
That's Ice-T, and this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We are talking today again to several people trying to determine what the coalition partners in the United States ought to do about the civil war in Iraq, how to cope with refugees. We'll hear from a reporter who tried to leave Iraq and had a fairly dangerous trip out into Turkey. Robert Siegel is in New York, where he talked to Turkey's President Turgut Özal about how that country feels and what that country thinks ought to be done. And an important piece from Wendy Kaufman about step families, new arrangements, how to behave with these newly constituted families.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back in the 1950s in Los Angeles, tenor saxophonist James Clay played with progressive jazzmen Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry. But by the time Clay's friends headed east to make names for themselves, Clay had returned to his native Texas. During the 60s, he toured with Ray Charles. Then he pretty much dropped out of sight. Now James Clay is making a comeback, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of his new record.
James Clay's reemergence on the jazz scene began a couple of years ago, when he appeared on a Don Cherry record called Art Deco. The music on that album owed a lot to the freewheeling but bluesy jazz Ornette Coleman pioneered in the 1950s. James Clay had learned that style firsthand, and playing with Cherry, he sounded all right. Now James Clay has his own album out. It's called I Let a Song Go Out of My Heart for the Antilles label. This time, the music is solidly in the jazz mainstream, and Clay sounds better than all right. Thank you. James Clay has described himself as a typical Texas tenor. As he says, that's someone who plays in a raunchy, straightforward manner with lots of emotion and few frills. True enough, he has a broad, dark sound that's steeped in the blues, combined with a swaggering sense of rhythm. The rhythm section on Clay's album has a lot to do with its punch. Cedar Walton plays piano, David Williams is on bass, and the drummer is Billy Higgins, who's known Clay since his old Ornette Coleman days. James Clay doesn't just play blues and full speed ahead burners. He also has a tender way with ballads. In the late 50s, family responsibilities called James Clay back to Dallas. Not long after that, Ornette Coleman's groundbreaking band made it big. One musician who'd worked with Clay back then predicted Clay would be the guy to take jazz the next step forward. But as James Clay himself says, and as his new album confirms, he's always been at home playing more straight-ahead music. And since jazz is now going through a conservative phase, James Clay is making his comeback at exactly the right time.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed James Clay's new album on the Antilles label. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
New York Times reporter Andrew Malcolm has written many articles on medical ethics. On the next Fresh Air, Malcolm tells us about the time those issues went from the abstract to the deeply personal, when he decided to take his terminally ill mother off the respirator and let her go. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.